Hey there, podcast listeners. I love using NovoPsych, which is why I'm really pleased for them to come on as a sponsor to our show. NovoPsych is the ultimate tool for administering psychological questionnaires, tracking outcomes, and informing treatment. With NovoPsych, you can easily access a wide range of evidence-based questionnaires and assessment tools. There's no more time-consuming scoring. It's all done very easily and automatically. There's over 100 psychometric tools available, and NovoPsych has assessments for specific things like trauma, personality, and many other presenting issues that will really help a schema therapist understand complex presentations. What I really like is having all your client data securely stored in one place, and it has really cool graphs and clear visualizations, which clients really like too. So if you're ready to enhance your practice, visit NovoPsych.com today and start your free trial.
Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to What's the Schemata. Now, it's Chris Hayes here, and I'm all on my own because my partner in crime, Rob, is actually going to present in this episode. So, this recording is from the recent Schema Therapy Connect conference that we held in Sydney in early November. It was a fantastic day. We had a number of different presenters, had about 150 people there in person, a number of people online. It was a great event, and we'll be doing this in the future for sure. This presentation is really looking at new developments in schema therapy and research and practice. It's a very, very engaging presentation looking at updating the listener in terms of new directions of research and where the model is heading. So without further ado, over to Rob Brockman.
The last couple of times that I've done this, I've been focusing on research a little bit just to do something a little bit different. And so I'm going to try to take you through, there's so much been happening in schema world around research in the past couple of years. I'm going to try to take you through as many things as I can. There's so many things that have been exciting me in the literature. And so I'm just going through trying to pick out things that might interest you guys. So I'm going to tag a bunch of things, but then I'm going to go into two or three things in some depth. And I'm going to start in a second, and we're going to press go in a second on this video. A little while ago, Chris and I were on a podcast with Eckhard Roediger, who's a past president of ISST, and something he said really struck me, actually, and I was thinking about that in the context of the research that was coming up. Can you hit play for me?
I think we need to be aware that we don't lose the connection with the mainstream of CBT, because this is the major thing going on for 60, 70 years now, and those therapies like RET from Albert Ellis, for example, like Gestalt therapy, that try to live in their own world in a more or less self-referential system, they will fade out over the years. And I think what will last is what we can contribute to the mainstream of evolving CBT.
So this is something I've been noticing in the literature, you know, and certainly he kind of summarized that in a way that it being necessary in schema therapy, that we don't go the way of things like, not to disparage something, but like Gestalt and other therapies that maybe live in its own ecosystem to a degree, and to get disconnected from the clinical literature. And so the kind of three themes that I've seen in the research literature involving schema therapy and the techniques over the past couple of years, one is what Eckhard's talking about. So connecting schema therapy techniques to the mainstream clinical literature. Number two is what I would call working through the exclusion criteria and or understanding the generalizability of schema therapy effects to new populations. Okay, so when they run a clinical trial, they do so under very strict conditions. Okay, so they control for everything, they control for comorbidity and all this kind of stuff. And that's not real, you know, and people are presenting with all sorts of things. So initially they excluded kids, they excluded older adults, they excluded people with autism, they excluded people with ADHD, they excluded people with intellectual disability, violent people, etc. So one of the things that's happening in the literature is they're going through now and they're looking at, can schema therapy be applied in these diverse contexts? And the third thing that I think is a theme is what you might call refining the model. All right, having a chance to sort of for the model to evolve over time so that it doesn't stand still. So let's go through. Now, some of the main examples I want to showcase involve imagery rescripting. This has been one area that's been heavily researched in the last 4 to 5 years. Some of the examples I'll quickly touch on are the IREM study. Hands up if you know what the IREM study is. Let's get a bit of a show of hands, about half of us. Also, imagery scripting for depression, imagery scripting for social anxiety disorder, and also things that really excite me lately. We're going to go a deeper dive into that. Imagery scripting for both trauma-related voice hearing and visual hallucinations. So I'm going to go a bit deeper into those things. But just a quick look at IREM. You can see here, this is the results of a large-scale randomized controlled trial between imagery scripting versus EMDR. The key takeaway here was, of course, that both treatments by follow-up were equally effective with large effect sizes on PTSD symptoms. As was discussed earlier, I think Chris might have mentioned 14 sessions of imagery scripting, no other bells and whistles, and no stabilization phase. And this has been a little bit of a thing in the trauma literature lately. We're seeing randomized control trials for things like imagery scripting, things like EMDR, where they've been testing out whether or not stabilization phase is necessary on average in a group study. And they're finding on average that it doesn't seem to. So this was very exciting for us, of course, because imagery scripting comparing really well to something like a gold standard treatment, such as EMDR for post-traumatic stress disorder. This was, of course, in a childhood trauma context. We presented this a couple of years ago, actually, because Adele Stravopoulos was actually studied here at UTS, and we supervised her on her PhD thesis. She was able to take the same protocol that they used in IREM and apply it to depressed clients. The same protocol, modified slightly for depression, and found significant large effect sizes on depression outcomes with imagery scripting alone. So no other bells and whistles around schema, no other bells and whistles around a complete CBT model necessarily, just imagery scripting, getting in there, yeah, roughly 14 sessions, doing the protocol, helping people process their trauma memories. Reliable change in 13 of 15 subjects and large effect sizes. Looking also at the links to the broader CBT literature also, I came across this systematic review that's recently been published. 10 studies to date has shown significant reductions in negative imagery in social anxiety disorder, that is image distress, image vividness, and negative beliefs. So a lot of work going on, you know, looking at imagery scripting as a standalone treatment. Now, here we go. There's some of the interesting stuff. So this is one of two studies from a research group led by Georgie Pawlik from Perth, the Perth Voices Clinic. Some of you might have seen her or heard of her. We did a podcast with her a couple of months ago, and she was talking about some of these results. So the effectiveness of imagery scripting for trauma-affected voice hearers. An open trial, she looked at 49 patients with trauma-related voice hearing. Roughly half of them met criteria for a psychotic spectrum disorder and the other half did not. And talking to her, she said the other half would basically be conceptualized as somebody you might think of as complex trauma more broadly. They offered between 7 to 19 sessions of imagery scripting. This is based upon what was available at the time. Really interesting thing about the research that Georgie's been doing, she's been doing it in a university clinic, but constrained by Medicare. She's been offering bulk billing sessions. Initially, it was 10 sessions, and then mid-trial, they had access to 20 sessions. So on average, people were engaging in between 7 and 19 treatment sessions. First two sessions involved assessment and then psychoeducation, the sequencing of memories, and then a homework visualization task. Of imagining themselves soothing their former child self, their little child. And then sessions 3 to 19, depending on how long clients stayed in treatment, imagery scripting one memory per session. So getting in there and doing the imagery scripting. Now, in general, I mean, if you can think about this, they're going back to some experience related to being triggered with a voice hearing experience, tuning into that experience in the context. Maybe you're at Kmart, maybe, you know, you're around about town, getting triggered, tuning into the feeling, and then taking that feeling back as in a float back. Really impressive results. Imagery scripting associated with very large reductions in PTSD symptoms and voices, that is both the emotional and physical characteristics of the voices. All right, so reductions in voice distress and voice frequency. This is at both the post-treatment and at the follow-up. So medium to large effect sizes in also the weekly symptoms of intrusions, voice-related distress and voice frequency negative voices, and a non-significant increase in positive voices. So a part of the study, they were also measuring voices on a weekly basis and its impacts, and these are also coming through with large to medium effect sizes by the end of the study. So that's really cool. All right. In my career, you know, since starting to look at psychological interventions for psychotic disorders or symptoms, even single symptoms, there's always been this idea that you come against, especially when interacting with those more with from a medical background, that doing trauma-based work with people with these kind of diagnosis could be dangerous or might trigger off more psychosis. And talking to Georgie and the results of her literature have shown that these people can be worked with within a trauma-informed basis and a trauma processing basis, which is really cool. And I think this is definitely one of the things that's happening in our field at the moment. Increasingly, we're looking at problems related to psychosis within a trauma processing lens, and it's not only schema or imagery scripting, but also with therapies such as EMDR. Now, really recently, she's backed that up, and she's become interested also in visual hallucinations. Okay, and the relevance, and how do we formulate, and how do you work with folks who might suffer from hallucinations on another channel, right? On a visual channel. Now, this is much more preliminary. They've only looked at this in 11 patients, in this one, this was actually just a 10. I think by this stage, we'd lost the 20. Right, so she only had access to 10 sessions again. So she's doing this research within a Medicare framework and offered everyone 10 sessions. That means eight treatment sessions, okay, because folks were engaged in assessment for one or two sessions at the beginning, assessment case formulation. Let's have a little look. Look at the imagery-based interventions. So there were sort of one to two imagery techniques per session applied from the following. So they would receive either a safe place image. Okay, I think we all know what a safe place image. This would be potentially one of the interventions. Something that they call a metacognitive manipulation of images. That is to show that images are only a mental event. And she gives the example in the paper. Participant has a visual hallucination of a man, an associated mental image of this man attacking them, and feels the visual hallucination and image is unsafe. The metacognitive manipulation may involve putting the man on a TV screen and changing the channel to make him dance, shrink or grow, go roller skating, or play with a puppy, kind of make it silly. So this was one of the interventions or the possibilities for an imagery intervention. Then we had imagery scripting. Okay, fairly typical imagery scripting as you might do in schema. So float back from a current visual hallucination or image to related past experiences, trauma, an emotional bridge to the past, also used as a diagnostic imagery, can identify key life events that link to core beliefs, current images and psychotic symptoms. A traditional imagery scripting, and there's an example in the paper here as well. I'm not going to read it out, but of going from a current experience of a visual hallucination involving a dog and then floating back to the past where she was actually attacked by a dog. Last but not least, something that she calls creating positive imagery. So deliberately generating positive images of the future to directly challenge any beliefs related to their experience of visual hallucinations. So if the participant believes that the visual hallucinations are a sign that they're going mad and that their future will therefore be bleak and spent mostly in psychiatric facilities, coming up with an alternative image of how it might actually turn out if that doesn't happen and if everything turns out okay, and engaging with that image. So a little bit about results. The intervention was found to be safe and acceptable in all 10 completers. There was one dropout, and it was to do with someone who had a caring role and said they weren't in a place where they could do this while they had a caring responsibilities. You can see here, this is the effects across the study, averaged across all participants on mean frequency of hallucinations, visual hallucinations. You can see that by the end of the treatment, large effects were found by week 11, right, on average, And very interestingly also, you can see at 3-month follow-up, a sort of rebound effect. How do you guys interpret that? How might you guys interpret that? So it looks like things are doing pretty well with the treatment. You get to sort of 10 or 11 weeks, and then you let them go, you end the treatment, and then 3 months later, you measure again. What do you guys think? A change in? So one of the things could be attention and support during the study, that now you don't have it, so you bounce back. That's broadly what I think, although I'd broaden that to say, I think that, and Georgie's told me this too, what she thinks, which is the same, that this is not a strong enough dose of an imagery intervention for somebody with that kind of profile of psychosis. So that's the way she's looking at that at the moment, and thinking that compared to the previous study on voice hearers who had basically double the amount of sessions available to them, they didn't get that kind of bounce back effect. So she's interpreting that to say probably they're going to need more sessions, and this is kind of ending the treatment early. She also increasingly looks at these clients through the lens of complex trauma, all right? And how many sessions are you going to need with someone where the issue is related to complex trauma and childhood adversity? So hold that in mind. They found very similar effects also for distress related to hallucinatory experiences, visual hallucinations. Again, a similar bounce back effect once the treatment ended after 10 or 11 sessions. So key ideas coming from Georgie's research and her lab overall: voice hearing and associated distress can be treated by targeting trauma-related voices with imagery scripting as a standalone treatment. It sounds like as little as 12 to 14 sessions. Imagery-based techniques can also seemingly be applied to visual hallucinations in a very similar way, although it looks like that you might need more sessions potentially. Also that auditory hallucinations can be mapped as modes or parts, and I'm going to show you something in a second that speaks to that. And also this idea that most patients with these symptom profiles might best be thought of within a complex trauma sort of lens in terms of how long treatment might go for. And, you know, consistent with Jeff Young's original ideas that of being the chronic clients, you know, multi-problem clients, attachment clients, needing longer-term work. She's now focused on actually testing a full schema therapy package for some of these populations, including chair work, and anecdotally finding quite nice results. Now, something I also got, we were lucky enough to go to Georgie's workshop in Bali. So this was in June. We often do a retreat once a year, and Georgie came over to present her findings and also some of the things she's been doing in the research. And I thought this was really cool. One of the things she puts in her formulations, this might be a fairly typical formulation for a voice hearer, okay, someone with trauma-related voices. And she has these little audio icons that she puts on there to signify within the formulation that those modes can be expressed through voice hearing. Okay, so I thought that was a really cool idea. Guys, let's come back into the large group reflections. That was a quick 3 minutes, yeah? Therapists love reflecting. They just reflect and reflect, and it's hard to stop them sometimes. But let's come to the large group reflections, actually. So I had a really interesting question, actually, just on the side there. Were they on meds, basically? You know, were these people on medication? On average, everyone was yes, on whatever medication might have been prescribed. And there was this idea of being relatively stable on their medication, so no acute psychosis, all right? These were all people relatively stable with residual symptoms, trauma-related symptoms, hallucinations.
Yeah.
What did we come up with? Any specific questions or reflections? Let's try. We're just gonna get our mic.
So I have a client with complex trauma who has had two psychotic sort of breaks, visual and auditory. The second lot happened after I did some imagery scripting of a not too strong trauma memory, but I've been quite concerned to do imagery scripting since she's gone back on the antipsychotic, and so it's really interesting. Yeah. But I don't know if you've got any thoughts or knowledge about if so she's stable now, she's on the antipsychotic, does it feel like it's safe to go back and do imagery scripting?
I mean, the limited research that's coming out suggests yes. I would ask, was she medicated and before?
No, so she'd gone off the medication because she'd become stable.
Right.
So she'd had a break of 6 months, and or maybe 3 to 6 months had been stable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Georgie, you know, talking to her, you know, this would be, it's a couple of things like this had happened during the trial, and then that would go back to like stabilizing her and making sure they're on medication and that kind of thing. And then, yeah, give it, you know, I think it would be appropriate to give it a go eventually. You wouldn't want to avoid it forever, but yeah. Yeah. But that, of course, that's it can really happen helpful. From time to time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other folks? Any other reflections or questions? Isn't it exciting? It's exciting, right? This has been a whole decades of like, no, you can't do things with them, that you're going to trigger off all these things, and things are changing afoot a little bit, yeah.
I guess one of the reflections that I have that you touched on in the work that I do with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse is creating the safety around how they can talk about it and finding a safe spot for them to talk about it rather than actually reliving it. And I think that really touches on it, whether they're going through psychosis or not. And from my own experience, I'm not working with a lot of clients going through psychosis, but I find your comments on creating safety for where they can, I guess, a platform that they can stand on and look back and not relive it. And I often talk about in a way of, we're actually going to look back at this time through adult eyes rather than you actually reliving it. And I find that's a really healthy platform for a lot of clients to relate to, that they don't have to step through it as that child. And getting that boundary in place and spending time on that boundary seems to get us a lot further to be able to talk about really difficult things.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So I think that sort of platform is very, very important, isn't it? But what this research is also suggesting is that adding in components of trauma processing might be able to add more to the mix eventually. Yeah, that we get a little bit further than creating only the safety part, but maybe it can be a part of adding something to the mix. Yeah. Other folks, we have time for one more? Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment on like clients with psychotic illness and how we can sometimes represent being part of a system that has perpetuated the trauma. So people that have been like taken down in a psychotic state and had intramuscular injections or engagement with a forensic mental health system. And I think that's like an added challenge for clients that we're working with. Yeah. Like they do need to have that stability for us to do this work. But I think we also sometimes need to name, you know, like put the system on the chair to be able to express the anger towards that system, for example, because that establishment of safety is sometimes a really complex thing. If they do trip into risk, then we have to then like push the button on an unsafe engagement with an unsafe system for them. And it's, I think, important thing to be mindful of.
Yep. Makes sense. Thank you. All right. Let's kick along, guys. We've got a few more things to get to. Similar to the trend with imagery scripting being looked at as a standalone treatment, we're also starting to see chair work being integrated into broader treatments. And there's a really cool book by Matthew Pugh, one of our colleagues in the UK, wrote a whole book on this, integrating chair work into a CBT framework. Hands up if you've seen this book, guys. Aware of this one, a few of you guys. I think it's a fantastic book and really good to see some of these things being integrated into broader stuff. I just saw recently, this study only came out in July, a research study looking at working with the inner critic for depression and just inner critic work, chair work for an inner critic experience. And so we're also starting to see research looking at this in this similar way that we had with imagery scripting studies. In this case, this was a single case series and with large positive effect sizes in 7 out of 8 cases where there was one dropout. So the second theme I wanted to talk about was this sort of working through the exclusion criteria and understanding the generalizability of schema therapy effects to populations that haven't been researched yet. I think Denny did a great job also of talking about that in a cultural context, and she went through a bunch of research related to that. Lars Madsen already talked about this study. This is schema therapy with violent offenders. So this is a part of working through the exclusion criteria. So in initial studies of borderline personality disorder, for example, violent offenders and people with violent histories were omitted from the studies, and they followed it up to check that out and getting positive effects in that context. More recently, also looking at the effectiveness of schema therapy, and can it be applied to people with more neurodiversity type profiles? And we're seeing more and more studies like this one, where they're looking at schema therapy in a context of comorbidity between personality disorders and autistic disorders. And so you can see in this particular single case series, 12 adults, significant medium to large effects on core beliefs, schema modes, PD traits, and general mental health symptoms, and social responsiveness behaviors in a sample with the comorbidity. Really exciting, but we don't have a lot of results yet. We're aware that there has been single case series looking at dissociative identity disorder. They set the agenda in 2019 with a protocol, and then more recently, just last year, published the first case report on this. I understand that there's going to be a single case series of, I think it's 10 patients with DID and schema therapy coming out in the next year or two. Okay. The third thing I wanted to talk about is something I would call refining the schema therapy model. And I think we've all seen this paper now. It's been out now since 2021, and it's setting the tone for basically more schemas and more needs, looking at expanding the model. We're now at a point where there are at least three new schemas and two new sub-schemas. Hands up if you're aware of this, guys, this research that's been coming out. So we're expanding the schemas. Also, has everyone seen Dave Edwards' paper, on schema modes? It's the most, this is the paper here. It's the most comprehensive kind of mode listing that I've seen, where he's attempted to look at all the literature and sort of put together any mode that's been proposed in the literature, right? And categorize them all, put them together. And remarkably, it took me ages. I went through and counted them all up. It sort of lists out 83 modes in this paper, all right? 16 parent modes, different variations, 8 distinct vulnerable child modes, 5 angry/unsocialized modes. Look at this. We're really, human beings love overcompensating. 22 overcompensation modes. Yeah. We even overcompensated on the modes. And what he calls 15, what he calls unproductive thinking modes, 15 different variations on ruminative kind of modes, which is really interesting. So one of the things Chris and I often talk about this, we're trying to figure this out, are there that many modes? We were just sort of talking about just different variations on overcompensation, avoidance, surrender, that they just kind of show up slightly differently, but they're still overcompensation. One of my favorite papers from last year, authored by Susan Simpson and Limor Navot. Hands up if you've seen this one, the pseudo-vulnerability paper. Yeah, about half of us. And what they were able to do is they sort of realize that there are a group of modes that are different, And in schema therapy training, what I see when people are trained, they go away and often, of course, quite enthusiastic about the model. And you go and apply it, and lots of patients get better and they feel good about the treatment. There are probably three sets of, and it makes sense, three sets of patients that you start getting problems or resistance and that sort of, become a problem for the treatment, feeling blocked. And the first one, at least this is how I see it, usually the first one are avoidance style modes. So you get the people in supervision coming, oh, I've got this detached protector, it's immovable, they don't have feelings, right? Or they won't do feelings or something like that. So therapist has to figure out how to get around that. The second lot are quite different in presentation. These are your overcompensation modes. Your narcissistic clients, your controlling clients, your demanding clients, your aggressive clients. And this is a whole different vibe. And it's like, well, what do I do with this? This is not avoidance. Actually, they're in my face now. And there's lots of feelings, actually. And so that's a different skill set. So working with overcompensation. And this is the third set, and it made complete sense for me, pseudo-vulnerability modes. Okay, modes that show up that look vulnerable in the room topographically. You might be seeing a lot of feelings, might be seeing a lot of crying, signals of vulnerability even perhaps, but something doesn't quite feel right. It doesn't trigger off an empathic response in the therapist necessarily, and it can be confusing for the therapist. And something about it, the more that you lean in on those kind of empathic qualities in therapy, it doesn't seem to make a reduction or to connect actually to authentic vulnerability. So they call them pseudo-vulnerable modes. They labeled the sort of top four in the paper. So we've got the complaining protector. We heard about that from Lars earlier. The helpless surrenderer. Attention or recognition seeking mode, and also a subversion of the self-aggrandizer, you might want to think of as a pity slash victim mode or a pity slash victim narrative. Hands up if you can relate to this stuff, guys, that there are a group of clients that trigger off something else in us, yeah, that's not necessarily just about avoidance or overcompensation. A couple of implications for schema therapy in the paper talking about trusting the therapist transference reactions. Okay, if you're feeling a bit off with it, if you sort of find yourself with someone who is seemingly vulnerable, but it triggers something in you that's less than empathic or might be outright annoyed or irritated, it could be that you had a rough day, but it could be that we're looking at a pseudo-vulnerable mode. And also that means that we're going to need to rely on more of our skill set, right, on the bad cop type skill set of empathic augmentation, setting boundaries, helping them become aware of this mode, okay? And of course, in this idea, if we lean too much on only the empathy and the attunement and listening to these modes and empathizing, we of course run the risk of maintaining them. I couldn't help it. Everyone else has been plugging things. So I thought, why not? But, you know, Andrew was talking about the importance of looking after ourselves in the first talk, and Chris and I have been involved in running some of these workshops after the past few years, and the next one is actually coming up in June. And on top of that, really cool topics, because we've got Susan Simpson, who co-authored that paper on pseudo-vulnerability. She's one of the headlining speakers on day one, working with pseudo-vulnerable modes and overcompensator modes using the drama triangle. We've got Yannis Breeders from the UK coming across and talking about body focus interventions within a schema therapy framework. Okay, this is going to be really interesting. There's no reason why body-based interventions shouldn't be really useful within a schema framework, because we know that bodily sensations are a part of schema activation. Okay, and there's a really cool topic on the third day by a fellow named Rob, talking about taming the inner critic modes. Now, you're going to get a little teaser on this at the end of this talk. Now, something that really excited me, guys, and I don't know what you think. I can't count the amount of times I've done a schema therapy workshop and we talk about research and everyone asks, what about DBT? Has there been a trial of schema therapy versus DBT? I can finally say the answer to that is yes. There has been one paper. It just came out this year. It was published. And we're going to talk about this a little bit and also on our tables. And I just want to make sure we've got timing. So the effectiveness of dialectical behavior therapy compared to schema therapy for BPD, randomized controlled trial, quite large. They had 164 outpatients randomized to the two groups. Very interestingly, 1.5 years of treatment involving one individual session per week and also one group session per week. Primary outcome consistent with the schema studies was a BPD-SI, the Borderline Personality Disorder Severity Index, which was
There was a standard DBT type program with a group and an individual session. And then there was a schema therapy group that did schema therapy group.
An individual.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. These are the characteristics of the patients. And I wanted to have a look here because you can see, I just wanted to show you guys, it was just super interesting how common comorbidity is. So if you look at about halfway through, it says comorbid disorders. So comorbid SCID 1 or Axis 1 disorders, all right, we're looking at a mean of 4 per patient. So on average, patients had, you know, they had a personality, say they had borderline personality disorder, and on average they had, up to 4 Axis 1 problems. Okay, and not similar, but you can see that comorbidity amongst the PDs was also quite high, with 1.35 additional diagnoses, Axis 2 diagnoses per person. All right, so on average, each person had another diagnosis that would apply, which I thought was extremely high. And if you go down, you can see, you know, the percentages on things like, so one of the highest ones, if I'm looking down here, was obsessive compulsive personality disorder. 36% of folks with BPD would also meet the criteria for OCPD, and 42.1% with avoidant personality disorder. So it shows, you know, the mixed picture with a lot of these folks. You know, it's so common, you're going to get a detached protector, maybe with an avoidant protector, and a detached protector, maybe with a perfectionistic over-controller. So the main findings I tried to pick out, because of course you can read the whole thing, I tried to pick out the most interesting parts and summarize. Both treatments demonstrate large effect sizes on BPD symptoms across 1.5 years of treatment. And there's a trend you can see. So on the two lines at the top is change in BPD symptoms. Okay. And there's a whole year of follow-up. So you can see there's a 1.5 piece on the graph, and it goes until 2.5 years. Now, what they found was no significant effect between the two treatments, right? So by the end of treatment and also in follow-up on both change in BPD scores and treatment retention by follow-up, there were no significant differences. If you look at change in BPD symptoms, there is a little interesting trend. You can probably see it. So at 1.5 years, the treatment finishes, and then you can see something happening with the orange line. I think that's maybe a similar thing that we were talking about earlier. That so 1.5 years of schema treatment is a little bit of a low dose of schema treatment, given that most of the RCT evidence in that population talk about between 2 to 3 years of treatment for a diagnosis of BPD, where both the problem and the therapy involve attachment. Right, that, so I don't know if that's true, but that's something I'm looking at, you know, that it seems that maybe the effects start to drop off once you stop the schema treatment, if it's stopping a little bit early, but they're going to need to back that up and do longer term studies to see if that comes through. The other trend, there was a trend if they looked at individual symptoms, so they were all non-significantly different. There was one that stood out as significantly better for DBT across 1.5 years of treatment, and that was to do with anger dysregulation outcomes. So with clients that were extremely dysregulated in their anger, they tended to do a little bit better in the DBT study in terms of the anger dysregulation, and it kind of makes sense, focusing on specific skills, things to do within the context of anger dysregulation. And there's also a trend, you can see this showing up in the second graph in favor of schema therapy in terms of dropout. That is that those who drop out of DBT tend to do it early. So you can see the blue line, there are a group of folks that are dropping out pretty early. They didn't like DBT, or they didn't want to do it or something. They drop out early. And that effect actually disappears by follow-up. Okay, so schema therapy and DBT end up on a level playing field when it comes to dropout by follow-up. But there is a bit of data to suggest a sort of maybe a kind of halo effect or with schema that folks are staying in treatment longer, which disappears over time. And some folks, significantly more folks, dropping out for DBT earlier, but then that effect disappearing over time. So anyone, yeah, down there we go, down the back. Yeah. We've got room for two.
One of the thoughts I had was that DBT and schema are very different therapy modalities.
Yeah.
And I wonder actually whether there's some research that might actually be interested, not in comparing the two, but actually to combine them. So you can do DBT, you can do schema, and you can do DBT and schema. The way that I'd be thinking about it is if we were treating diabetes, for example, there's medication and there's lifestyle change.
Yeah. You're not going to say do one or the other. Take a medication or change your lifestyle.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I think because they target such different things, it would make sense to actually combine them rather than compare.
I think Chris Hepworth would love to talk to you more. And this runs a course on this. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, combining them. One more, guys. Get either question or reflection. Participation. Yeah, down the front here. We've got, this is you're our best contributor, I think.
Yeah, I don't mean to over-control, but
give me the microphone.
The however many weeks, you keep talking about this bounce back effect.
Was non-significant. That was still equally,
that's
right?
Probably
But I think visually you can see something maybe happening with finishing a treatment a little bit early or.
Well, yeah. And I think maybe we're over correcting on what that response is, because even as it flatlines like that, I think we'd all be pretty happy
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah, yeah, it's totally. You know, I'm a perfectionist, so I'm looking at all the outcomes and makes sense.
But I was just thinking the practice effects of whether it be 12 weeks of work or 19 weeks of work, or I think that was, you know, 52 plus 26. I don't know what that is, but let's say, you know, however many. Yeah. That's a lot of.
Look at the symptom change. It's still really, really cool.
Effect there. Yeah. And then you take the training, that weekly training away. And then we're looking for self-determined behavior to use the skills. Like I'm looking at that going, bloody crap.
Sounds good.
It's fantastic, you know. So just different reflection or lens on the data. So
positive mindset. I like it. All right, guys, the last thing I'm going to talk about, you all know this is my axe to grind probably with Schema, and that is the way that we deal with the inner critic and especially the punitive critic. And I wanted to talk to this a little bit. Has anyone seen me present on this before? Hands up if you've seen me present on this before. Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. So this is based on a workshop that I ran with Wendy Bahari and then a subsequent ISST bulletin paper that we wrote together to talk through this issue about how we deal with punitive critics. And if you've ever watched Jeffrey Young do this, and of course this is in the standard protocol, how do we treat with punitive critics, guys? What's our stance when it comes to the punitive critic? What do we want to do with them? You're out, you know, no more of this. And if you keep going, you're out of here. And even to sort of dramatically kick out the chair. Okay. And, you know, I think we've all probably had success. We're not going to go through the video, but I think we've all probably had some success with that where it lands really well. And the client goes, oh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. Or, gee, I've really felt you protecting me and that's what I needed, right? But if you're anything like me, you've also had situations where that sort of intervention sort of lands flat in a way. Can I get a show of hands? Who's done this and it lands flat in a way? It's like a little secret on it. So it's basically all of us. So, and this general approach to the punitive critic as a sort of banishing is based on the view of a punitive critic part as a toxic echo of an abusive past. It's the idea from Jeff Young that with, right, kids are soaking in these negative messages and they kind of go on replay, all right, in certain situations, the sort of messages that we heard growing up. And the therapist's treatment of the critic as an internal bully that requires strong limits, even banishing, okay? The view of the child as needing protection and validation. So a question for you guys, like just to think through, what if these harsh rebukes cannot win the exchange? You know, if something goes wrong, it falls flat or it actually escalates things. The harsh critic becomes harsher, the harsher that you are. Okay, how do we think about this? How can we understand it? Are we just bad at schema therapy? Is it that we're just not good at doing the dialogues? We didn't win or something? You know, activate our failure schemas. Or could there be other ways to approach this? Now, there are some potential reasons or explanations if you look at the broader literature for how you deal with self-criticism. One idea from ACT is that it could be too aggressive or punitive to meet, say, a punitive critic with more punitiveness or that sort of sentiment. It can reinforce a punitive schema or network, activating the network. This is actually predicted in ACT theory, and it's why they try to disengage from thoughts like that, hence not to maintain them. This will often evoke an increase in fear and vulnerability. They may say something like, I feel more unsafe with your harsh rebuke. When you said these things, it made me feel more unsafe. So it's a counterproductive sort of outcome. Another thing that I find sometimes it seemingly triggers a coping response in the client that, of course, would risk blocking some kind of corrective experience. A related thing people have talked about is things like maybe feeling some sort of disrespect in terms of culture or even their parents, right? The insinuation that you're pushing their parents out of the image or rebuking them, and can, of course, trigger off coping responses akin to things like the compliance surrenderer. Similarly, again, triggers a surrender response where to a particular schema or mode, an over-identification with the critic. Okay, so it might be sort of trigger a surrender response to the critic. We're saying it's right, it's true, those kind of things. Of course, this is going to block processing. And the thing that comes up for me is the idea that maybe the punitive critic might have played a sort of survival function
at least in the past, in the childhood past, you know, what's the function for a child of rebuking myself, criticizing myself, being the one, being the problem in a family system? And, you know, often some evidence for this I see is that they'll often say things like, you know, I need that side to survive. So this kind of function just starts seeping out of the client, you know, and this is only in my practice. This is not research-based at all. I estimate about 85% of punitive critics, I only work in private practice, just to give you context, do have some sort of recognizable survival function. If you drill down and you interview that side, they can speak about a survival function. And that leaves the other 15% potentially as being more pure sort of menacing critics. Interestingly, Scott Kellogg, who we had on the What's the Schemata podcast 32, was on board with this and talked about very similar numbers. So I think this is something that we're all dealing with. We're out there, we're trying to deal with these critics, and therapists are realizing that it, you know, pushing it away doesn't always seem to be as effective as we might like. This idea is also consistent with most parts-based models. So if you step outside of schema and you look at things like IFS or compassion-focused therapy or EMDR or structural dissociation model, for example, are much more consistent with a model that includes other ways of dealing with a critic such as compassion. There's also a principle from what's called process-based therapy, which is that no strategy is universally beneficial. Right, the therapist shouldn't expect one approach to always have this positive outcomes. Okay, hands up if you've tried to do mindfulness with someone who's anxious, only to find that they get more anxious when you do the mindfulness. Right, so this is something that we have to face as therapists. That we in earnest we look at the evidence base. We try to do something that helps. The evidence says on average should help, and some of the time we have these kind of effects that don't land. And how do we think about that? So I've made a list of some of the things that come up when I've interviewed a critic for role and function. And I wonder if you've heard this kind of stuff. So one, I'm not going to go through them all. I'm going to pick up my favorites. To maintain a connection or attachment to parents and family, my parents actually loved me. It's just that I was bad. I was the problem. So if I criticize myself, then I can still be loved. It's not cool to be criticized, but I need attachment. Similarly, to maintain a connection to an abuser, if it was my fault, then I can still be attached to the abuser/abusers. Protects me from further abuse. You know, if I stay down, if I beat myself up, then I'm a smaller target, or I might cop less actual abuse if I beat myself up first. My personal favorite, stops me from being lazy/unproductive. I need the critic to drive me, or I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't get anything done. Some of these familiar, guys? So this leads to a principle that critic modes can often have a positive intention and provide motivation and energy for the coping modes. So it can be that there's a positive intent or function, but not always. Sometimes you land on critics that you might call pure menacing critics that just go back to, I'm not trying to help her at all. She's just a piece of shit and needs to die. I want to destroy her. Right, so about 15% of the time, this is where you land, or at least this was my experience, and about 85% of the time, you land on something where the critic feels it's doing something for the client. And so it does lead to sort of potentially two types of punitive critics. This idea came straight from Scott, talking about in the podcast. Now, firstly, a pure abusive or menacing critic that is an echo of an abusive past. You might see that in more severe presentations of BPD, complex trauma, dissociative disorders, DID. Roughly maybe 15%-ish of punitive critic presentations. And a second subset, punitive critics with a discoverable coping function that is a part of a survival mechanism providing motivation and energy for the coping modes, maybe a lot higher than 15%, something close to 85% of the time. Some other evidence considerations for these ideas. Firstly, all other modes in the model are seen through a functional lens. It is a little bit strange that this is the one mode that we say, no, it's bad and it has to go all the time. Right, that's a little bit strange. In our model, all of the other modes have a function. They create a message, they protect, they whatever it might be, stand up for needs. Number two, it's actually usually possible to easily establish a function through interviewing the critic. Right. So on most occasions, roughly 80-85% of the time, it's usually fairly easy to derive a function out of the mode if you put it on a chair. Also, the idea of schemas, EMS, that is, which underpin the punitive critic, have an adaptive function in the model. So we know that all modes, including the punitive critic, are made up of schemas. Schemas like punitiveness, defectiveness, mistrust abuse, failure. And from Jeff Young himself, says that schemas begin as adaptive and relatively accurate representations of a child's environment, but they become maladaptive and inaccurate as the child grows up. So if the schemas that underpin a punitive mode are seen as adaptive in the past, therefore perhaps the mode itself has some sort of adaptive function. Also, the idea that prominent emotions evoked by the punitive critic, like shame, fear, and guilt, have long been theorized to have survival value, such as group acceptance, affiliation, even by Jeff Young himself in the original text. The fifth thing I'm thinking about, a relatively common response to successfully, even when you successfully banish a mode like a punitive critic, is fear. The client then becomes vulnerable and says things like, I don't know what I would do or who I would be without this mode. And you can trigger sort of feeling of vulnerability or fear about not knowing what to do. Hands up if you've experienced that. Many of us, yeah. Number six, even the menacing critics, even the 15% that seemingly have no function, can be seen as acting out the internalization of an abusive past consistent with evolutionary perspectives, like Paul Gilbert's compassion-focused therapy. So the question becomes, okay, so why do kids internalize their parents' voice, even if it's negative and abusive? And Paul Gilbert says that basically that's what your brain's designed to do. It's designed to soak in your environment. It's not designed as a kid to question everything that your parent says. If your parent says that don't go down there because a lion's going to kill you, the ones that said why probably got eaten, right? And so it makes sense that we challenge them as we get older, but initially sort of are hardwired to sort of take on board things, right? Our parents' voice. So some treatment implications. We need to assess for potentially two sort of subtypes of a punitive critic via interviewing the critic, such as we would do with a coping mode, to understand its role and function. Okay. Two types of critic, pure abusive versus functional. With a pure abusive, you might take more of a limit-setting stance, more of a sort of, I'm not going to allow you to treat Jenny this way, even potentially to kick it out. And maybe with the more functional critics, the need to lean more towards a compassionate approach based on ideas around empathic confrontation. I understand. I get it. You want her to be effective. You don't want her to be lazy, you know, and you're afraid for her. It's just that. This is not okay. This is not working, actually. You put too much pressure on her. So we lean on that empathic confrontation. So a basic framework, as we might have do for coping modes, applies: pros and cons, chair work dialogues, empathic confrontation, and building a healthy adult compassion. Here are some questions that I find really useful for interviewing the critic chair for role and function. Why do you feel the need to be so strong here in the session? What role do you play in Jenny's life? Everyone knows Jenny, yeah? This is my one client. Yeah. How long have you been around in Jenny's life? Why did you need to develop? What role did you play in Jenny's life? What do you wish for Jenny? What do you wish for her? Do you try to help Jenny anyway? This is a leading question, maybe to survive. See if you can catch it. What would happen if you weren't around? And what would be so bad, or what would happen if you left her alone if you weren't around? Okay, guys, that's the end of the presentation proper. We do have some time for some questions, and then we'll be doing something more important from 5 o'clock.
It's maybe one or two questions, given it's just about to turn over to 5 o'clock.
We don't want to delay.
Yeah. Any questions?
Any questions, guys, reflections? Yeah, down the middle here.
I think you kind of said this, but I just wanted to make sure. So with critic modes that have a function, a survival function, whether it's about attachment to the parent or this part helps me do things, wouldn't it just be better to call them the earliest coping mode or something like that, and not, like, do we need to be separating that from the other coping modes and calling it a
critics? Yeah, I think it's a good question. It would be take a revamp of the model to move critics into the coping modes. Yeah, in some ways, they've kind of gone that way with the research we showed from the international group. They're already looking at critic modes as surrender modes, actually. They call them surrender modes. Mm. So to some degree, the literature is going that way where, if you're sort of fused with a critic like that, it's a way of coping with it. Yeah. Yeah. So it could be going that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
All of this is very preliminary. So, you know, but the model's evolving, you know, it's not staying still and responding to therapist feedback and what's working.
Yeah.
Any other questions, guys? Who we got?
I think it's a wrap.
I think if anyone talks now, there's going to get stabby eyes. Yeah. Because it's time for the most important part of today, which is the socials. So, guys, a big thank you for turning up. And I've got a couple of things. That's fine. So one thing, you had a little announcement about maybe a...
Yeah, I mean, with two things. I wanted to... Thanks, Rob. Rob was the backbone of all this, you know, so really sincerely...
Local organizer. Organized. Yeah.
Organized Slipstream. Also, look, we were talking about we obviously got the online platform, Schema Therapy Training Online. So we've set up like a discount code. If you want to, you know, use a course, there's 25% off for the next year. So you have to put in a little code, discount code, and it's 25 Connect. So you write that down.
Write it down, guys. 25 Connect.
Oh, this is for the pre-recorded 25 workshop. Connect.
I'm never going to say it again. So write it down.
So not the live in training.
Schema Therapy Training Online.com. Yeah. There's so many courses. Last courses are up there on forensic stuff. We've got courses on mixing DBT and schema. There's courses on EMDR and schema.
Yeah,
and
imagery. Scripting.
So go and check it out. Yeah. Guys, lovely seeing you all. We'll see you out in the drinks section. See you soon. Can I just also, guys, just say a wonderful and big thank you to our audio visual girl. She did an amazing job today. She was all over it. Yeah, I really appreciate it.